Thank you very much, Gail. It's a great pleasure being part of this Otherworld project. Often when you're putting together a grant application, your basic way of understanding what you're about to do is, how can I use this process to do what I otherwise would have done anyway? And it's a testimony, I think, to the strength of the project that I'm being pulled in very different direction to those that I would myself be being pulled. Gail was my undergraduate lecturer, so I also get to be on a project with my undergraduate lecturer, which is has a nice circularity. But Anthony and Melinda and Sam, and of course other people on the project, Alexis and so forth, it's a great privilege to be working on this. And thanks, Meg, for your paper. In fact, I think there's quite a lot of resonance between the papers today, and in my case, somewhat unintentional. I'll get out my PowerPoint. We've all got maps today, so that's another resonant mind move. It's a gift. So I was going to extemporize, and I started taking notes to sort of get my mind thinking over the things that I wanted to talk about, and I ended up writing a paper. So I'd meant for this to be a slightly more engaged form of presentation, but I'm going to read some things out. Something else connects Anthony, Meg, and myself, and that is that we're all contributing to a companion to the work of Junket Sayer. In my case, I wrote an essay about J.M. Kitsaya, world literature and the South, which was really motivated by the fact of participating in this project. And so even though Kitsaya is a writer that I promised myself I would never write scholarship about, for reasons I won't go into, I've ended up writing this chapter and thinking along in the groove of Kitsaya, the powerful current, and meeting people, also being pulled along by that current, thinking similar things but in a slightly different way. So I hope I'm not just repeating things that Meg has said. Something that I observed as I was thinking through this idea that Kitsaya has provoked us with the South, when I saw it in strategic terms that he was talking about the South. He wasn't talking about Australian literature. He wasn't talking about South African literature. He wasn't talking about the global South. He wasn't talking about world literature. And this is something Meg said to me in an email. He was talking about a scene of habitation that was more than any nation or country, but certainly was a lot less than the world. And if you think in Bourdieu terms, in terms of how writers position themselves in particular creative field, it's actually extremely distinctive thing that J.M. Kitsaya has done in placing himself, or in a sense creating a field for himself to articulate his work into, that a huge number of people are now thinking, oh, what is the South? How do we connect these different fields of writing? What brings them into a certain kind of relation? And that in itself is a testimony to his enormous presence and also his creative strength. So with that in mind, I've sort of been thinking about the literary dimension, I guess, not so much the hemispheric geographical dimension, the literary dimension of the South. And I tried to go with Kitsaya, but also with a certain inherent skepticism pushed against it. This is sort of where things have got to. I'm not going to talk about his work until the very end of this paper. So when we came to write the introduction to the Cambridge Companion to World Literature, my friend Jared and I surmised that the only factor common to all currently circulating definitions of world literature is a concern with totality. And for this reason, we came up with the following definition of world literature: the totality of verbal art. So not just literature as written, but also oral literature. The recent resurgence of world literature, we therefore concluded, reflects a renewed appetite for addressing the question of totality in literary studies. This tendency obeys broader methodological currents of the humanities and social sciences. In a rapidly globalizing world, in an interconnected world, literary studies too has needed to adopt what Peter Singer calls one-world thinking. There are many ways of thinking about totality, and the question of literary totality has no doubt arisen in one form or other in all literary cultures. I think all literary cultures have a version of world literature, past and present. In the contemporary discussion of world literature, however, totality has tended to refer to quite a limited range of things. Above all, the concept of totality has been hitched to the concept of the globe, considered as a single unified totality. More specifically, the tendency has been to consider world literature as literature in the age of globalization. And I get quite pissed off because I think that most of what passes for world literature is really just literature and globalization studies, which is a very different thing. Accordingly, the organizing concepts and metaphors of the new world literary studies have been devised in order to think about the ways in which the constituent elements of a globalizing world are connected. This, of course, has been the self-conscious theme of the work of Franco Moretti, who talks about the literary world system in terms of graphs, maps, trees, and so on. But it applies across the spectrum of the now conventional contemporary approaches to world literature. Whether it is conceived as a system of circulation, a relationship between literary fields of literary production, literature as a praxis across the global political economy, or even, and I stress, literature in its resistance to globalization. We're talking about literature and its relationship to system. Chris Andrews isn't here today, is he? Chris is a contributor to this Companion to World Literature, and he writes a great chapter about the valves of world literature. Valves, another great metaphor for where things pass through, the conduits, a great chapter. This means that just about all conceptions of world literature place emphasis on networks and connectivity. Typically, this has involved looking to networks that connect literary actors across national boundaries and the way in which translation especially connects literary cultures and allows literary work to circulate between linguistic communities. If world literature is the moniker for discussing literary totality in the age of globalization, we might characterize the methodological impetus underpinning this field as being one or other iteration of network thinking. In calling this presentation rather melodramatically against network thinking, which is against Emily Apter's Against World Literature, for those who know what that might mean, I am not suggesting that network thinking is always a bad thing. My intention is to point out what network thinking leaves out and perhaps is incapable of apprehending. And I would say that what Anthony and Meg did in their papers is very much also against network thinking. It's thinking relationality, which doesn't necessarily require an empirical connection between things. And I think the lovely speculative readings that Meg gave is a good example of what I'm pointing to in this paper. Those schooled in post-colonial theory and criticism have tended to be skeptical of the resurgence of world literature. They scoff at world literature for being glibly cosmopolitan and putting to the side questions of structural inequality and a specific history of imperialism that gave contemporary globalization its shape. Many post-colonialists simply have continued as they had previously, with the strategically minded simply replacing the term post-colonial with world literature in their articles and books. For those who have sincerely engaged with world literature as a field dedicated to the question of literary totality, though, there have been some more probing criticisms. I'm not going to run through these, but it is worth observing that these are concerned above all to place the question of the relationship between literature and structural equality at the centre of their critiques and analyses. So I want to address only one strand of research within the post-colonial critique of world literature, the desire to focus on literary networks that exist within and between literary communities of the global south. The imperative underlining this should be obvious enough. If the new world literary studies have tended to focus on networks and modes of connectivity that bring literary cultures together through the channels established by those occupying a dominant position within the global structure of power, you can tell I was extemporizing as I wrote that sentence, the so-called global north, then those concerned with the Global South will respond by putting the spotlight on those networks and modes of connectivity operating within and between peripheral societies. So it's still about the network, but instead of networks amongst dominant societies, and Meg's map earlier is very helpful here, it's more about connection between it. So just pointing out something about this term Global South, which I'm not sure that Kutsaya is entirely across when he talks about the concept, is that it's replaced the third world, or those who use this idea of the Global South use it consciously as something that comes after being able to talk about the third world and, you know, post-Cold War, and try to think about how those who exist in structurally dominated societies relate to each other. And the other thing to say about it, and both these articles on the Global South mention it, is that it's perceived as a project. That it's about, it's not just that it exists as a thing out there, but it's something that gets produced and created, and as a recent CFP for a conference says, it's the basis for transnational political collaboration. So it's very much something that's brought into being or enacted through the scholarship and work that happened with it within its rubric. So you can kind of see in the last 10, 15 years the kind of look of Global South studies. Here's an initiative trying to bring together concept thinkers, moments, and so forth out of the University of Virginia. There's a journal called The Global South, which has some interesting papers that are freely available. There's a group within the Modern Languages Association that brings together those interested in the Global South. And then, of course, as ever, there are conferences. Here's one that happened last week, Thinking the Global South, a Critical Vocabulary for the 21st Century. And so something that attracted my eye when I was at the MLA convention for the very first time was a number of panels on South-South translation. So here's one, and here's another South-South translation, the geopolitics and geopoetics of circulation. But this is a larger phenomenon, that you get a lot of focus on how societies and literary cultures of the Global South are interconnected and maybe in part of a kind of collaboration against the Global North. And this has got a historical dimension. This is a great project. Monica Popescu, a great scholar who I met a few years ago and was reacquainted with her at the MLA. She's doing great work on the Third World and the sort of proto-Global South in the Cold War era. There's an element both of a project of trying to bring into being a set of collaborations amongst those of societies of the Global South, but there's also a sense, and this is from an article that cited a lot in this thing, a sense that, well, it doesn't actually exist yet, or it need to be brought into existence. So there is no surprise that the global translation flux is predominantly north-north, while south-south translation is almost non-existent and north-south translation is unequal, kind of stating the opposite, the obvious there. But nevertheless, you know, the idea of south-south translation, of people translating things within the South, is a kind of key part of the project of the Global South. This is what I'm trying to point to. So I do not doubt that these investigations are both compelling and in some way necessary. They promise to give a more complete account of how literature and literary meaning moves around in an interconnected world marked by uneven and combined development. Without having read a great deal of the Global South scholarship, I can imagine that much of it acknowledges that South-South connections tend to be tenuous even while they are full of decolonizing potentiality. Like the older utopia of third world internationalism, these studies point to the project of transnational subaltern collaboration. They also promise a richer, more varied set of intercultural possibilities than that yielded by homogenizing literary markets. The thing that worries me, though, is that the methodological underpinning of this research, what I'm giving the label network thinking, continues to operate within the scholarly sphere dedicated to thinking about literary cultures of structurally dominated societies. And I think this is a great example. So something that the South, Global South scholarship has unearthed is this Lotus Journal of Afro-Asian Writing, which was part of, I guess, the non-aligned moment, the Third World moment, bringing together writers from across the Third World. And this scholar, Hala Halim, wrote a very interesting article about LOTUS, the Afro-Asian Nexus, and the Global South comparativism. But as this great scholar Mona Popescu pointed out in her presentation at the MLA, this was all funded by the Soviet Union, and LOTUS Journal came to an end at the end of the Soviet Union. So it's actually pointing to, I guess, the imperial patrons of the Global South more than it is, I guess, the utopian promise of the South-South collaboration. So above all, the problem with network thinking is that it hitches interpretation and criticism to empirically existing connections between literary actors, whether they be writers, publishers, readers, critics, publicists, translators, and so on. It means that our conception of world literature remains fundamentally a positive one, a vision of how literature accommodates itself within a world determined by structural inequality and the persistence of all kinds of cultural domination. So my question, and this is, I guess, my question in this group project, is it possible to think totality without placing the emphasis on existing networks and their modes of connectivity? Thinking about the possible relationship between things that don't have any obvious connection carried the methodological pitfall of comparativism for its own sake. And I think when we talk about the South, we should be aware of this. One juxtaposes two works, discusses their similarities and differences, and then makes of it what one will. You can always do that. You can always compare two things. The essays I'm working on at the moment are considering the history of concept used by scholars in world literary studies to think of literary totalities in a speculative way, especially through the act of comparative interpretation. So what is the basis for comparison, and what's the way of understanding literary totality through interpretation? These form part of a legacy of critical humanist discussions of world literature, a legacy that largely has been eclipsed by the positivist underpinnings of the new world literary studies. I haven't made a slide here, but Alexander Veselovsky's historical poetic, Eric Auerbach's idea of an Ansatzpunkt, and Edward Said's proposal to read contrapuntally across the imperial archive, these are concepts that I'm using, but I'm not going to talk about them. When it comes to thinking about the question of literary totality in the present global situation, though, there's a specific motivation for avoiding network thinking. The annexation of literary activity by imperialist cultures and determination by global markets has actually had the effect of motivating literary communities to recover and rehabilitate the local. In fact, it might even be that the characteristic motivation for literary activity in capitalist conditions, the pursuit of non-economic value, is aligned precisely with the desire to escape networks in our time, that those that want to produce meaning outside of global markets want to get out of interconnectivity.